The Money Show
with Motheo Kgaripe
on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday edition of The Money Show on this very, very short week, but not short of some big, big news coming out of South Africa's Parliament. The South African Speaker of Parliament, Nosiviwe Mabisa-Nqakula, resigning today, a day after losing a court bid to block her arrest over allegations of corruption. That's the first story we'll be looking at on The Money Show today. Mpumelelo Mkabela, independent political analyst, will be taking us through that particular story. And it seems while we wait with bated breath for some interest rate relief in the country, South African policymakers are deliberating over the country's inflation target, with Governor Lesedi Ganyago telling Reuters earlier today that the SARB still pondering going on a lower inflation target compared to the 3-6% target range we are currently operating on. Now, countries like the US target a 2% inflation, while Japan has also kept historically low numbers. Now, what would this mean for a developing economy like South Africa? We'll try to pose that particular question to Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91. He's, of course, covering our markets tonight. And how are you currently surviving this high interest rate environment? How are you dealing with the exorbitant bond repayments? Did you downscale maybe on your car? Or are you doing everything you can to keep the set of your favorite wheels? Join us on this particular conversation. You can call us on 011-883-0702. Or you can also WhatsApp us on 072-702-1702 in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Then we'll talk about your privacy rights when it comes to using search engines like Google. Of course, Google has been quite naughty of late, secretly collecting data from its users. It's been hit with a lawsuit in the United States. We will be finding out how them deleting all that data they've collected will affect the company, but also what your rights are when it comes to using some of these search engines online. Jan Vermeulen, editor at My Broadband, joining us for that conversation. Later on The Money Show, we'll be talking business unusual, psychological safety in the workplace. Simpiwe Moyo, organizational behavior specialist, joining us for that conversation. All and more on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Motheo Kgaripe
on 702.
Let's get into this breaking story this afternoon. You've heard of an eyewitness news, and Nosiviwe Mabisa-Nqakula officially resigning as National Assembly Speaker amid those corruption allegations. In her resignation letter, Mabisa-Nqakula saying that this does not show any admission of guilt regarding the allegations that have been leveled against her. Of course, she's facing 12 corruption charges and one of money laundering. A big, big one, of course, for the governing ANC as well. Let's chat now to Mpumelelo Mkabela, independent political analyst. Mpumelelo, big news coming out of Parliament with Mabisa-Nqakula resigning on those corruption charges. Is this a good move in terms of, you know, voters seeing government, you know, clamping down on corruption in South Africa?
Yes, Motheo, good evening. I think it's a good decision she has taken, albeit belatedly. It could have been much better had she resigned earlier instead of trying to filibuster the law enforcement agencies from arresting her. But it's a good thing nonetheless that finally she has resigned to face the charges that have been leveled against her.
This doesn't normally happen, of course. If a political figure in South Africa usually faces corruption charges, they'll draw it out in the courts. They won't leave their post while they try to prove their innocence. Is this the ANC's renewal or too little too late?
Well, it can never be late to try and fight corruption, especially if you are a senior member of parliament. You recall, Motheo, that a lot of the state capture activities and undermining of state institutions happened precisely because Parliament did not do its job to perform its oversight role on the executive and the rest of the administration in the state. So, because of that lack of oversight duty on Parliament, we found ourselves with state capture, where democratic institutions were hijacked, and in cabinet itself under Jacob Zuma was redirected to serve other interests other than the public interest. So it's important that parliament is constituted by people, or is even perceived to be constituted by people who are upright and whose integrity cannot be questioned. And then they can play that role properly, and they can fulfill their constitutional obligations as per their oath of office. So it's important that when somebody is seen to have done something wrong, they resign, and then they don't carry that that blot with them when they perform their parliamentary duties.
Now, Nosiviwe Mapisa-Nqakula will face, of course, 12 corruption charges, one of money laundering for allegedly soliciting 4.5 million rand in cash bribes. This is a Speaker of Parliament. How do you expect the governing ANC to respond to this? Because this is, of course, quite a senior member in the cabinet.
I think the ANC is most likely going to welcome it, and I don't think she would have resigned without informing the ANC. Remember, she's primarily, before anything else, she's a member of the ANC. She was also a member of parliament on behalf of the ANC before she became the speaker. In fact, even the allegations against her, she's alleged to have done, to have broken the law while she was a cabinet member. Being in that position primarily because she's serving her organization, the ANC, which then won votes to represent the public. So she wouldn't have done this without having informed the ANC, and most likely the ANC has okayed it. But the other implications, Motewa, here that are very important given the position she occupies and the allegations against her and the decisions she has taken now to step down. South Africa, your listeners would know about this particularly. South Africa is struggling to get out of the grey listing that has been imposed against it. And a lot of this has to do with allegations that our law enforcement agencies are not able to deal with money laundering issues, instances of corruption.
And convicting those that are corrupt.
Exactly. So when you have the speaker resigning from her position, it's also a sign of accountability, even though we don't know whether she'll be convicted yet, but at least the political judgment side of things, which doesn't require criminal lawyers to argue in court, it's pure political judgment. You take the fall and then deal with the criminal justice system later. But at least the political judgment side, you can say, it's working when people are put under pressure. We need to see more of this.
It's only a few weeks before South Africans go to the polls and to elect the next government that comes in. Do you think this, of course, this is going to be a dent to the ANC image going into those particular elections, especially after the Zondo Commission, but also just looking at how high level the corruption can go within the governing ANC?
Yeah, it's a big issue. And if you look at their manifesto, the ANC, they have made it a priority that they want to fight corruption. But of course, that's not a new priority. It has always been their priority to fight corruption, at least on paper. However, when it comes to acting against one of their own, it's often, it struggles to do that. So, and in the manifesto, they admit that that's one of their weaknesses, that that they are being perceived to be soft on corruption, and they're saying it's a mistake that they would like to correct. So if you have a senior member, like a speaker, resigning because she faces allegations of corruption, I think the ANC should rather celebrate this, celebrate in inverted commas, because corruption is bad anyway. But at least take it to heart that actually somebody is resigning, and the ANC can go to its voters and say, listen, you can see that we've begun now to clean house. Now we encourage our members to take the fall even before allegations against them can be tested. But as soon as there's a clear indication that you will be arrested or you have been arrested, you can step aside. And even more importantly in this case, that she's not just stepping aside as a speaker.
Yeah.
She's resigning entirely as a member of parliament. And that's very important. So the ANC shouldn't go out there and say, yeah, well, we defend one of our own, we support her and all of that. It should simply say, well, she has taken the fall. And as the ANC, we have it in our manifesto that we won't be soft on corruption anymore.
All right, that was Mpumelelo Mkabela, independent political analyst, talking about the resignation, of course, of the Speaker of Parliament, Mapisa Ngagula, this afternoon.
You're with Motheo Paribe on 702 and Cape Talk.
Now, I don't have much of a sweet tooth, so I wouldn't have kept an eye on the prices of chocolate on the shopping aisles. But it seems the shooting up of cocoa prices has also made sure that chocolate prices are going up. Let's talk now to Anthony Gerd, the co-founder and director at Honest Chocolate. Anthony, just how much is this particular shoot up of the price affecting just the commercial prices of chocolates?
Hi there. I think we won't probably see it in the next 6 months because most companies like us, Honest Chocolate, we buy in like six months to a year in advance. So it would have secured the old prices. But I think, you know, like in 6 months to a year, you're going to see some major increases, especially in the commercial ranges. Yeah.
And what's causing the shoot up of prices of cocoa? What is the struggle in the market that's making sure that price is going up?
It's really simply a lack of supply in the main cocoa regions, which is Ivory Coast and Ghana. Those two countries, they account for about 50-60% of the world's cocoa. And they supply the big players, you know, like the Cadburys and the Lindts. So they have had huge crop failures over the last sort of 2 to 3 years, brought on by El Nino and with global warming, climate change. So really there's a huge issue and other issues as well there, but affected crops that have to be replanted. So basically just a really low supply in that region. And then therefore market has just gone up.
The Ivory Coast also looking to increase its own prices of cocoa. But I'm sure South African shoppers will want to know when our retailers will really start feeling the pinch. We're already in a high inflation environment. The last thing you want to hear is that those home comforts that you have to deal with this tough economy are also going to be quite punishing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be... I don't know for sure about the big players and how much they stockpile. But I think they'll bring the price increase forward, and I think by the end of the year with major increases, because even if the crops are good that side, it's going to take a while for things to really get to where they were. For us, for Honest Chocolate, we have been buying from Tanzania since we started, and it's not affected by the same conditions, and we've been paying about double market price from the start to get ethical, direct, organic cacao. So, for example, we're not affected now, but because the price in the general market's got so high, ours will definitely rise at the end of this year as well. So you're going to see a lot of changes. And I think, and I know that the big players, you know, the massive companies have been experimenting with cocoa alternatives. So like flavorings and things that carob it taste like kind of like chocolate to substitute into candy that has very low cocoa content, if you know what I mean, high sugar, high dairy stuff. So there's going to be a lot of that as well.
I don't know how much those that are chocolate snobs will be willing to go for that idea, but of course that price at historical highs of nearly $10,000 per metric ton in March this year. How is this likely to affect West Africa, where of course most of this produce is coming from and a lot of those economies relying on it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not an economist, so I won't be able to say it deeply, but I know that the farmers, you know, are going to be looking for alternatives if they don't have any crops. If the prices are this high, I'm not sure how much of that increased price actually goes back to the farmers or stays at the, for example, the Ghana and Cocoa Board or distributors. Or, you know, I'm not quite sure because we have a direct relationship with our producers. But there's a lot of other things going on in, for example, Ghana, where there's a lot of illegal gold mining, where they're sort of ripping up
some of the land,
cocoa plant, plantations. Yeah, and I mean, you know, fair enough. If there's more money to be made in that, and people aren't getting a fair wage for their cocoa, then you can understand that.
And have you been able to work out favorable contracts with your direct suppliers during this time? Because, of course, that direct relationship could help in making sure that you pay just a little less than the rest of the market.
Yes, no, you're right. You know, we've been working closely with Koku Kamili, which is a sort of social enterprise in the center of Tanzania. And we've got a really good relationship. So the way it's actually directly affected us now, being a small business, you know, we have to buy our cocoa up front directly and pay a lot of money up front and then try and work that back into profit later. So it's always a cash crisis. But so what we've had to do is buy a lot more cocoa this time around to secure the current price, which puts the small companies like us on the back foot. But we had to do that. Then we are in constant sort of talks and they've been saying, it's chaos out there. So we'll have to just keep talking and hopefully they don't raise their prices too much. And obviously people who used to buy from West Africa and now the price is so high will probably, come to Tanzania and say like, well, what can we get here? And we'll have to just ride that out, I think.
That might be favorable for them, but an increase for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, that was Anthony Gerd, co-founder and director at Honest Chocolate, talking about the rise of cocoa prices. International cocoa organizations saying that the global cocoa supply will go down by almost 11% during the 2023-2024 season. So there's lack of supply of that cocoa. Do expect the chocolate slab to be just a little bit pricier when you grow. Get your groceries.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Not much to shout about on the markets. I still think it's the Easter hangover, that long pause between the 28th and the 2nd of April, really affecting trades on the local JSE, at least in the EU markets as well as the US. So joined now by Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91. All red except for the mining shares that were up today, Chris.
Yeah, good evening, Matteo. It was a little bit of a mixed day. I guess we closed down 0.5% on the day. It's a little bit better than it had been trading earlier on in the day, with the market taking a little bit of cheer out of what's going on in the US Open, which we can talk about in a second. But as you said, not much by way of company-specific news. We had a quarterly production update out of Goldfields. We had the special dividend being paid by Life Healthcare. So if you're a Life Healthcare shareholder and you look at your shareholding down 36% today, don't panic. There's a 6 Rand special dividend that's come out there today that accounts for the vast majority of that share price move. And we did have a number of stocks going ex-dividend today, which did create a little bit of a distortion on the market. But as you indicated, a soft-ish day with not an awful lot in terms of corporate news.
But the market, of course, was waiting for Fed Chair Jerome Powell to speak. I don't know if you've caught a little bit of it this evening. Of course, that's currently happening now around interest rates, possible cuts this year, and how the rest of the world economy will be affected.
Yeah, I've had a brief look at the headlines. Although he speaks regularly and has spoken as recently as the end of last week in public forums, there's, I guess, heightened concern given that over the last few days we've seen inflation data coming through a little bit hotter than expected. We've seen indeed growth data both out of the US and out of China coming through a little bit better than expected. We've seen the oil price closer to $90 again, which is not great news from an inflationary perspective. So I guess heightened attention at the nuances of what he might be saying, and being the clever man that he is, he's not saying very much, indicating that interest rate moves will again be data dependent. We did have some data coming out of the US this evening, an ISM services number, which looked a fraction soft of expectations. We had some inflation data that looked a little bit better than expected, and we had another strong jobs number. So a little bit mixed, but probably not enough to upset the apple cart just yet. Remember at the beginning of this year, most market commentators were probably looking for 6 rate cuts in the US. So that's a cumulative 150 basis points this year. That's already been paired back to 3 rate cuts of 25 basis points each, so only 75 basis points of rate cuts year to date. It remains to be seen whether that particular view stays or whether it becomes slightly more hawkish again. But equity's certainly sitting there wondering what's going to happen to the rate cycle, and hoping that at least the 3 25 basis point cuts currently baked in are going to materialize.
Another man was saying a little bit more today, the governor, Lesetša Ganyago, telling Reuters today that the SARB will ponder around a lower inflation target compared to the 3-6% target range. We do know, of course, the SARB has kept rates unchanged at 8.25%, at least since May of 2023 last year. How do you think this will affect the country's look at interest rates if we do go for a lower inflation number?
Yeah, I mean, it remains consistent with what Lesetša's been saying for quite some time. I think, you know, he's been on record for a while that he would like to see the inflation band a little bit lower, and certainly that he would like to see inflation below the midpoint of the existing band, in other words, below the 4.5% mark, before he were to even contemplate cutting rates in South Africa. And I strongly suspect he would not want to lead the US Fed in terms of rate cutting either. He'd much rather see that the first rate cut was in the US before he kicked off a rate cutting policy in South Africa, rate cutting stance in South Africa. So, you know, at longer term, low and predictable inflation is good for economic growth. It's good for economic planning. It's good for economic growth. It's good for monetary discipline. So, you know, I think it's unlikely that our guidance range is going to change in the near term. But to have that as a goal in the longer term, to continue to keep inflation at a low, stable and predictable level can only be a good thing for long-term economic growth.
All right, that was Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91, covering the markets for us there. I'm sure a lot of South Africans would just want to hear the word cutting of interest rates. It is 6:30 now, time for Eyewitness News headlines.
Motheo Paripe on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Let's get into business unusual now. Talking tonight, psychological safety in the workplace. Now, psychological safety is the belief that you won't be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, concepts that you want to bring up with your colleagues. It's a shared expectation held by members of a particular team at work that you won't be embarrassed or rejected or anything like that if you are to bring up your ideas on how to be better productive or better strategizing in terms of the company. But how does this affect accountability? Are you allowed to fail in that particular space? We chat about that now with Sipiwe Moyo, Organizational Behavior Specialist. Sipiwe, just breaking down that psychological safety, how important is it for corporates?
Thanks for having me, Mateo. It's so important. I think we know that when people are able to speak up, ask for help, fail forward and experiment, we know that it increases innovation. It increases what we call employee voice. In other words, it is so bad when psychological safety is not there, to the point that we've seen so many studies where a junior can see that this particular project is not going to work. But because there's no space for them to say that, to raise divergent views, to warn that something is not going to work, they allow that particular project to happen. And unfortunately, the organizations pay the price. So it's so important to cultivate that space where people do feel that they can ask questions, they can speak up, and being able to ask for help. It is absolutely critical for creativity, for innovation, and it's also linked to high-performing teams.
I know there's no such thing as a stupid question, but let's look at executive and board level when it comes to psychological safety. I mean, you're paid there to have highly strategic ideas, to have ideas that will take the company forward. So presenting something that's lackluster and your colleagues possibly calling you out on that, how do you balance then the culture and the company on psychological safety when it's at executive level?
Yeah, we still need psychological safety even at executive level, because there are power dynamics in every boardroom. There's always the senior guy. There's also always the guy who has the power and the influence, even if they're not the most senior, but maybe they're a subject matter specialist, so they hold what we call expert power, or they have institutional knowledge. They know the organization so deeply to the point that their voice is is firmer, their voice is louder in that boardroom. And even in those boardrooms where people are executives and so on, you still need psychological safety for the people who are less influential, maybe who have less experience than that guy, will be able to call them out. Without psychological safety, people end up being territorial. So what happens, even in that exco, the head of operations will talk about operations and finish. The head of finance talks about finance. They finish and everybody keeps quiet and wait for their turn, to the point that everybody feels, I cannot say anything against or when someone else has voiced an opinion. So it is really, really bad. But what psychological safety is not, it's not an environment where there is no accountability. It's not an environment where people cannot say this idea is not good. But it is an environment, on the contrary, where you've created an environment where people can differ. We don't want artificial harmony, but people can differ in a respectful way, but you'll be able to allow divergent views to come. So it's not this lackluster culture where it's free for all. We cannot hold people accountable, or we allow bad ideas to emerge because we're feeling that we cannot correct each other. On the contrary, it's a culture where we're brutally honest about ideas. It's just that we are not attacking the person.
How do you facilitate then a platform for this to thrive? Because, of course, at work, there are different age groups. There are those that have the institutional knowledge of the company. They've been there for years. They've had ideas that have worked before. And those that have just come into the company with new ideas. How do you make sure that those two sectors of the employees do not clash when it comes to, the psychological safety?
You've got to be very strategic as a leader. As a leader, sometimes you miss out on great ideas because there are people who are not feeling very, very comfortable. So you have to seek out divergent views in that meeting. You've got to encourage some of the people who are maybe less vocal, give them a space, ask them directly what do they think. You've got to ask questions differently. So, for example, in order to create such a nice neutral space, you've got to be able to ask questions like, guys, if we didn't care who came up with this idea, what would we do? If we had a magic wand, what would we do? What that does is it depersonalizes the idea, because sometimes people don't voice out, don't speak up, because they kind of understand that Mutewa came up with that idea, and Mutewa is too powerful and influential to the point that when you raise concerns, views about that idea, they feel that you are attacking them directly. So as a leader, you become quite strategic in focusing everybody on the ball. So it's not because we're just creating this kumbaya culture, we are not able to have brutal conversation. But what it does is it creates that view to say, if you were looking in from outside, what recommendations would you make? And you go to people who might be speaking a little bit less. What you are then doing in that team, you are going to be able to get divergent views emerging. And as you're doing that, people can see that you're fostering open communication. You develop trust, and people, because they believe their voice, they are able to speak up a little bit more. You promote collaboration by doing that, and you can even feel trust increasing, because trust is also a function of trusting your character and trusting your competence. So the more we interact, the more trust is built. And to the point that if we have toxic behaviors, we address them head on as a leader in order to make sure that that voice from divergent people around the table emerges. Because if you only listen to one vocal person, there are certain viewpoints that you are missing. And that, as a leader, you are really robbing yourself of some really great views.
There's one example where this has worked. Google's 20% time, where the company allows you, encourages you to work on something else other than the projects that you have for work. And they've been able to come up with things like Gmail and Google Maps as a result. So it does, give some proper results. But you're someone who works with these corporates, the companies that need to come up with this sort of culture in the company. Do you have case studies that you can share with us where this has worked in making sure that the productivity and the profitability of the company is still high up?
Yeah, absolutely. So many case studies where I think the biggest fear for leaders is that this psychological safety thing is mumbo jumbo. It is soft. people must toughen up. This is a workplace. And we've seen environments where you convince leaders that this psychological safety is very beneficial and they argue against it because for some reason they believe that it takes away individual accountability. But research and so many case studies that I've found, Motheo, shows a very interesting link between psychological safety and what we call proactive career behaviors. So this includes people taking initiative, seeking feedback, and identifying innovative solutions to challenge. So it is not true that when you foster psychological safety, you reduce accountability. In fact, psychological safety breeds things like accountability and other proactive career behaviors, because what happens is when employees display these proactive career behaviors like accountability, those actions encourage others to do the same. So we've seen so many case studies where leaders were very concerned about accountability and the fact that psychological safety will diminish accountability, and we've managed to convince them that yes, we do need psychological safety, but we need it in conjunction with accountability. And so many of these case studies we've seen where suddenly people are acting in a proactively safe environment where there were too many incidents in the workplace. People were afraid of even reporting incidents. They would hide incidents. They would hide mistakes. But when we fostered and rolled out a program to implement psychological safety, we've seen a reduction of safety of safety incidents and an increase of proactive safety behaviors. We've seen an increase of high-performing team, an increase of innovation, and it is absolutely no doubt that when you're intentional about fostering both psychological safety and accountability, the results speak for themselves.
And is there a metric to measure, you know, the impact that psychological safety has on an organization? Because CEOs will tell you they want to see the numbers, they want to see the graphs, they want to see if they do invest in a particular thing, especially something that is not quite tangible like the psychological safety, it will bring the results to the company.
Oh, yeah. I mean, most leaders and CEOs, that they're interested in the bottom line. There's been countless studies that, you know, some of the organizational behavior outcomes that we measure in my field, things like job satisfaction, things like well-being, things like performance. It sounds like soft outcomes. But what we know is that psychological safety leads to an improve of job satisfaction. It includes an improvement of well-being, an improvement of innovation. And those in particular then link towards hard outcomes like performance, profitability, and increase in productivity. So there's absolutely no doubt that you can increase productivity, profitability, and performance through the improvement of psychological safety. And there is a psychological safety scale that has been developed by people like Amy Edmondson. And we've seen a lot of studies that have linked that particular psychological safety scale, when it's improved in the organization, to lead to other harder outcomes like profitability, productivity, and performance.
Well, that was Business Unusual with Sipho Moyo, organizational behavior specialist, talking about psychological safety in the workplace. On the next Money Show, Chantal Marx, head of equity research at FNB Wealth, will be our investment school head teacher. She'll be discussing ETFs versus mining stocks and which can be best for your investment portfolio. Then Sonqoba Vuba, former managing director at Perpetuate and entrepreneur, will give you tips for your small business. Then we will help you analyze and reflect on all the big and finance stories that came through on the day. That's all on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
Thank you for joining us on The Money Show. The search engine Google has been forced to delete millions of data records as part of a settlement for a lawsuit filed against the company in 2020. Now, the complaints accused the world's largest search engine of improperly tracking the web browsing habits of users who thought they were browsing the internet privately. Now, the case alleged that the Alphabet company secretly collected data from people using its popular Chrome web browser in a private incognito browsing code. Now, of course, Google now slapped with a lawsuit and will will have to delete millions of data, but still not paying for what they did. Let's talk about this with Jan Vermeulen, the editor at My Broadband. Jan, is this a slap on the wrist for Google, something they can just push to the side and continue doing something else?
Good evening. This was a lawsuit that I was kind of dubious about from the beginning, because incognito mode was never a mode that blocks all web trackers on the web. I mean, Facebook can also collect people's data while browsing in incognito mode. The one difference is that it shouldn't be linked to any. What happens when you go into private browsing tab or incognito mode is you're essentially logged out of everything that you would normally be logged into. And so whatever, you know, you're busy browsing won't necessarily get linked back to your actual accounts that you're usually logged in with. So that's one thing. But this particular lawsuit, while, you know, Google's trackers on various websites continue to work, and I think that they probably, they might have gathered analytical data from, you know, what people were doing with the browser that was not necessarily linked to you personally. I just didn't see this lawsuit going particularly far. So yeah, they've reached the settlement, and Google agreed to delete everybody's data that they gathered while they were browsing in incognito mode, and they didn't seem too fussed about it. They said, yeah, you know, we're happy about, you know, deleting old data that we collected that isn't really linked to anybody personally anyway. So it's one of those situations where both sides are calling it a win. I think the only people who won here were the lawyers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Google also, the plaintiffs had wanted Google to pay around $5 billion in damages, but they've been asked, of course, to pursue those particular cases individually. But looking at the change in, you know, the guided or targeted ads in the social media space, we've heard of Google saying they're going to be blocking the third-party cookies. This was around February, I think. How will this change the landscape? Because this, for social media companies, has proven that they can be profitable through these ads, but it seems all the things that they use to make sure that they are valuable could be taken away.
Yeah, the Google cookie shakeup is potentially huge. And to be honest, I haven't really gotten like fully to grips with it yet. What the total implications are going to be of it. Some folks in the ad space are worried that this will just help Google entrench its dominance further, and others are hopeful that, you know, if Google does this in Chrome, which is currently the world's most popular browser, then hopefully that means that privacy-preserving cookies will make their way into other browsers. And if you look at what Apple is doing, Apple already in its Safari browser on Mac and on iOS has ways to just block tracking outright. Firefox has ways built into it now to just block tracking outright. There's the Do Not Track standard in web browsers that hopes to get well-behaving websites to not track people against their will. So there has been a push to not gather so much personally identifying information about people, and hoover up so much of their browsing habits, and hopefully not gather more information than you need to just serve the ads that you need to serve to help the web be free. So, how exactly it's going to shake up, I think, remains to be seen. It's a huge change. And for me personally, it's difficult to predict how it's going to shake up.
All right, that was Jan Vermeulen, editor at My Broadband. I'm sure a lot of us will be hearing this news, but still using some of these search engines without reading the fine print. I thank you for joining us for that particular conversation. It is 7 o'clock, time for Eyewitness News now with Mbali Dlamini.
The Money Show
with Motheo Kgwaripe
on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Let's talk about South Africa's policy uncertainty, especially towards the elections. An election, of course, for any economy is a point of uncertainty. There could be a leadership change, a change in some economic policies, and that causes some jitters, of course, in the market and in the general economy. And we'll find out what these effects will have on South Africa's economy going into that elections that happening in a few weeks. Professor Raymond Parsons to join us, the economist at Northwestern University's Business School. A cross-cutting number of events and trends converging at this particular year, influencing economic perceptions in the first quarter of 2024. We look at some party changes, how the coalitions will be affecting the running of municipalities and other investment programs or larger projects like manufacturing and steel projects in the country. Let's chat now to Professor Raymond Parsons, economist at Northwest Business School, to chat to us about the uncertainty index in the country. Professor, welcome again to The Money Show.
And good evening to you.
About 70 countries around the world are due to get into elections. South Africa, one of those this year. Why do elections cause so much jitters and uncertainty for the markets?
Yes, I'm glad that you mentioned that particular global perspective, because unusually this year there is this high coincidence of elections in a number of countries. And what our research has shown when we do our policy uncertainty index over the years is that normally there is a bit of a spike. It depends, of course, on the circumstances and what is at stake in a particular country. But these indices do tend to spike at a time of election because they are competing visions and of course, policies. For South Africa, however, what is unique here is that we have not been here before. In other words, for several decades, we've had a dominant party running the country. Now, for the first time, there's a much more competitive situation on the political front. And because it's such an unusual situation, people fluctuate between wanting to panic on the one hand, or on the other hand, just being worried as to what might happen in terms of the outcome of the election. I think the big issue here is clearly because we haven't been here before in this format of politics, There is uncertainty, particularly on the investment side, as to just exactly what the outcome will be. Will there be coalition government at the national level? Will there be coalition governments at least three of the provinces? And would this have any implications for how our economy is run? The fact is that we simply haven't been here before, so we don't know what we don't know, as it were, as to where the chips may fall.
This is especially different in South Africa, as you've said earlier, because we're used to the governing ANC getting a two-thirds majority or something close to that. So that gives some sort of uncertainty to say which government is going to be likely running the country. And there would be a continuation of policies that they've introduced in the past tenure. But looking at this particular election, things could change. And how do the chips fall then for South Africa's economy?
Well, you see, I think what is interesting here, I'm just an economist who looks at the economic and the business implications of these political factors. The fact is that our political pundits are heavily divided as to what they think the outcome is. And I look to them for some guidance, and I hear, well, the ANC's majority might be 51, it might be 48, it might be 45, it might be 39. Now, those are all different outcomes, and the sort of coalition you go into will differ depending, although the ANC will still be the biggest single party, it makes a big difference whether they're sitting with a 38 or 39% of the vote or with 48 or 49. So there is that uncertainty, and therefore I like to say for the moment, when we talk about the GDP of South Africa, it's not only the gross domestic product, it's also the gross domestic politics, and sometimes very gross.
Then when we look at the uncertainty index, the policy uncertainty index, especially in South Africa's context, can you give us the historical numbers that we've had and how they've declined going into this 2024 election?
Well, this index, which we drew up 6 years ago, so it's been going for 6 years, and so it has a track record. And on the whole, it seems to have captured the ups and downs of uncertainty. On the whole, if you look over the 6 years, it's been more in negative territory than it's been in positive territory. And you probably see that reflected in the same period in which our economy has not performed as well as it should. And clearly, of course, there's been issues such as COVID and so forth. There are external factors. But it's the internal factors over which we do have control that we need to do a much better job. So what the index has been saying for some time, and now it's saying it more loudly, that we have an election coming, we really have to build a bigger, stronger, and better economy after the election. We can't go on being happy with a 1% growth rate. Some people say it might be 0.9, some say 1.2. Are we reduced in South Africa to the point at which we argue about decimal points in our growth rate? We could grow 3% and 4%. We've got to do that, and we've got to put in place the sort of things that are necessary in order to do that. So I'm hoping that the good economics that we need will be supported by the good politics that needs to come out of this election and the necessary leadership that will make that possible.
In measuring this particular index, I mean, I'm sure you would have considered things like the State of the Nation address, South Africa's, the budget speech that came through from Treasury as well, MPC meetings, as well as the GDP growth number that you've already touched on. It's not just the election that is affecting this particular reading. Given some of those factors, why do you think there's been such a policy weakness?
No, I think we must keep it in perspective. What the index shows every time, every quarter that it's produced, it weighs up the positive factors against the negative factors. And in some cases, it's the positive factors that indeed dominate, in which the index will decline a little bit. But where you have a quarter in which the negative factors outweigh the positive factors, as they did in the last quarter, the first quarter of this year, partly because of the political issues, then it tips that index into a higher category. So one must always keep a perspective, and what we do each time the index is produced, we weigh up the positive and the negative. And this time, although they were positive factors, they were clinched a little bit by the negative factors. Hence, the index edged up, but it is still in negative territory. So that's a very important message. Irrespective of the politics, we've got to get this economy right, and we've got to do a lot better than we've been doing so far. And one of the factors has to be that after the election, we must take steps to ensure that we can reduce policy uncertainty so that investors want to commit themselves, that we can get job-rich growth, and that we can build a bigger, stronger, and better economy in the aftermath of this election. So it's a crucial election from that point of view, both from an economic and a political point of view. In other words, our GDP is two sides of the same coin for the foreseeable future.
And Prof, the President, Cyril Ramaphosa, announcing those 12 key infrastructure projects. So some positive things came through this year as well, looking at how the private sector has also spoken out, saying they're ready to help governments with those skills that they lack in terms of South Africa's logistics, the power crisis that we currently face. What other positives could make sure that this number gets better in future?
I think the important point, the theme here is, quite rightly, there's cooperation between government and business. But what is the story line here is not that we do not have good plans or projects. It's the issue of implementation. Implementation is absolutely essential. If I had to say three words, it would be implementation, implementation, implementation. That is apart from an election. That's something that government and business must do prior to the election and after the election, because there are projects we need to get off the ground which are announced, And this is where the cooperation between government and business is so important, to expedite implementation. It's not that there are not issues, that there are not policies and projects that could make a big difference to this economy. The issue is we throw our weight behind the implementation and the capacity needed to get that implementation that could make a big difference to our economic future.
As an economist, then, looking into your, I won't say a ball or anything that you would look into, after the elections, should we find ourselves in a coalition government? Because, of course, an ANC-run government would have been more, sustainable in terms of looking at the future of the country. But one, if we do get a coalition government, that is, it's going to be new. Policies are going to be new. Economic-driven policies are going to be new because these are two parties coming together. How is that likely to affect the consistency that the market needs?
I think the whole point I've made is we simply don't know, because we're in new terrain we've never been before. All we can say is, yes, if you look at the track record of the coalition at the metropolitan and local government, it's not an inspiring record. But what we need to say that if this country is going to move into coalition governance at different levels on a much bigger scale, number one, we must learn from other countries that have had successful coalition governments. And secondly, we must not repeat the mistakes we've made so far. This is tremendously important, that if we're going to get coalition governments, we need rapidly to develop the norms and the guardrails that are necessary for a successful coalition government. But what that combination, it's precisely, we don't quite know where the chips will fall. But we do know that whatever you decide on a coalition governance, you need norms and stability in order to retain the confidence of investors and business and in order to get this economy moving. So the important thing is we must, if we are going to have more coalition governance, we must make it work successfully, learn from the world and learn from our own mistakes.
All right, Professor Raymond Parsons, not looking into that crystal ball, but saying it only going to be South Africa's way of handling a coalition government. How quickly do we settle in order to make sure there is policy and policy certainty, rather, going forward after the elections?
You're with Motheo Faribe on 702 and Cape Talk.
Now, I don't know if you've used an online service or any service at all where you've asked the service provider to pay you back your money. How long does that initially take compared to the time, I mean, you take when you click on a particular product and you pay for it online? That seems to be quite quick. But when you're supposed to get paid back by this particular company for either a service you're not happy with or something that needs to be returned, it seems to take quite a long time. And that's exactly what our consumer ninja Wendy Nola will be tackling today, looking at what your rights are when it comes to those repayments and how long should a company take in terms of giving you your money back, because it does take a snail's pace when it's the other way around, when the company is supposed to pay you. I remember I just went to the Atlanta just a week ago and the hotel took a deposit. I'm still waiting for it, and they told me it would take 2 days. I've been in South Africa for the past 5 days. So when it's time for the service provider to pay you back, it does take a little while longer. So I'll be finding out from consumer ninja Wendy Nola how long a company should take and what steps you can take as a consumer to make sure that you get all your money back.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola joining us today. Many companies quick to take your money, unjustifiably slow to pay it back. What are our rights when it comes to this, Wendy?
Hi, Mateo. We don't have a lot of rights because the sort of time frame for this sort of thing is not legislated. So I'm just annoyed because, look, obviously in some cases it happens smoothly. I only hear from people where they haven't been treated right for the most part. So when it happens, when you know, so the typical scenario will be a company has owed someone a refund for a while, you know, like a while, days, weeks, months even. And then they finally were, okay, we'll refund you. And then it's like you must wait 7 to 10 working days or 7 to 14 working days, which is like up to 3 weeks. And because that's their processes. They have certain days in which they refund and the process takes this amount of time. I mean, they've already done you down, right? They owed you this money. You had to fight
and you want
for
your
it.
Money
now
back.
You've won the fight, but now you must still wait. They're sorry for the inconvenience. Now just wait. And they're just, that's normal. And as you say, when it's the other way around, if you owe them money, my goodness, do they have an arsenal of horrible things they can do to you, right? It's penalties. It's
interest.
It's we can hand you over. Then you get more costs. And then we'll do the old adverse listing, commonly referred to as blacklisting on your record, so you messed up if you want, you know, any new credit. I mean, all sorts of things. Other way around, well, you just wait, you know, just be grateful we're giving you the money and, you know, keep quiet, sit over there, it'll be fine. The hypocrisy, double standards is shattering. And why I thought to talk about this, and I must admit, with all the long weekends and everything else, 2 extra days out of my working week to get responses from companies. I've sent a media query about this case and I haven't had a response yet. So I'm not naming them. But Kevin wrote to me to say that his tracking company double debited his agreed fee this month. So they took 539, that's quite a big fee for tracking, 539 rand and 87 cents on the 26th of March. And then they took another 539 rand and 87 cents 2 days later. So, okay, mistakes happen. And I've obviously, one of the questions I've asked the company is how many of their clients, of the other clients that this happened to, because systems don't normally go wrong with just one person when it comes to double debits, as we know from other cases. And maybe there's a listener out there who's thinking, ah, I know which company this is, it happened to me too. But anyway, it is a particularly nasty thing to happen. It's money that the company is not entitled to take. So, yes, it's not about the mistake, I always like to say. It's how you deal with it. So what should happen? What would you say, Mateo? Fix it quickly, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I would say. So, do whatever it takes to put that money back where it belongs as fast as possible. But no, Kevin says, when I called just now to sort it out, they told me that because the debits were both for the same amount, the system doesn't allow them to do a refund and they can only reallocate it as next month's payment.
No, what if you need the money?
I wish I was making this up. He says, can they do this? I literally don't have a spare 539 Rand this month to see me through. It seems fairly outrageous to me. Let me know what you think. Well, I said, I don't think it's fairly outrageous. I think it's totally outrageous. Is there a law that prohibits them from doing this? As I said, I can't think of one specifically, but our financial service providers are compelled by government to, in capital letters, treat customers fairly. That's abbreviated by the industry to TCF, which loses a lot of its meaning, if you ask me. It's a tick box exercise mostly. But if what they are doing in this case ticks the TCF box, there's something seriously amiss with this company, in my view. So in my media query, I said, your clients can't be made to pay for your system's limitations. We all know how to make immediate EFTs. Yes, it costs us a bit extra, but when we need to have the money in the other person's account straight away, then that's what we do, right? And why are companies any different? I said, do that immediately, because I know when there's a bad case, Mateo, and I take it up, like a really bad case, like the person will email me and say, like the next day, and say, the money was in, like it happened immediately. When they wanted to happen immediately, they make it happen immediately. So, yeah, as I say, it needs to work both ways. If you owe someone money and you don't, you make a mistake, you don't pay, whatever, or you short pay, there are consequences for us. So companies really need to get their, insert naughty word, together, you know, when these kinds of things happen. A couple of other cases around payments that are not on is companies forcing customers to sign debit order mandates. The Payments Association of South Africa has told me, because I've checked this out a few times on behalf of of consumers who don't feel comfortable due to bad experience with debit orders. There is no legislation, regulation, or rule prescribing the nature or type of payment for goods or services between consumers and service providers. And there's certainly nothing in the Consumer Protection Act which compels consumers to pay via debit order if that's what the supplier is insisting on. So that's good to know. And finally, if you buy a product online, this is a common one, and they can't supply it, you know, that one out of stock annoys people. Or you buy something and you don't like it, you can exercise your legal right to cancel for a full refund within 7 days. You have to send it back within 7 days or cancel within 7 days. You have a right to a refund in both cases. But what companies do is they'll say, oh, we'll credit you. And they wait for you to object and say, well, actually, I want a refund. So don't accept for that credit, will credit you thing and feel grateful. If you want to have the money back, if you don't want to be tied into spending your money with that company again, then say, actually, I will have a refund. Thank you very much. And just to know that is your right, because a lot of people sort of go along with a, yes, we'll refund you. Okay, thanks. And leave it at there. But
I think
actually,
it's because the companies know that's, that if they say, let's credit you, you'll probably take that as the easier option, because chasing some of this money could take a long time and people aren't really
exactly
into admin as well.
That brings you back to my original point. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, because if you want to get something else, like immediately, you want that money immediately, to maybe buy another brand or choose another color or whatever the case may be, then you have that money available to you immediately with that company, albeit. But if you now you want the refund, yeah, are you going to wait up to 14 working days? I mean, interestingly, if you exercise your right to the cooling off period, you don't like what arrives, it doesn't look like it did in the picture, you can cancel within 7 days and they must refund you. But the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act gives the supplier up to 30 days to actually refund you. Most will do it sooner than that, but some do actually take that whole 30 days to do it. And as you say, then you're stuck without that money. So in some cases, the credit would be better. But just to know, if you actually totally up to your ears with that company for whatever reason and you want to take your spend elsewhere, don't think that you have to accept the credit when you are entitled to a refund.
So you definitely have to be a stubborn consumer when it comes to this one, because, 30 days is a long time to wait, but it is your money. And like you say, it is your right to make sure that money is brought back to you. But looking at that prescribed 7-day cooling off period, when that time lapses, does the company say that they're now, you know, own the money that you gave them, or should they reestablish communication with you to try and make sure you're satisfied?
No, they don't have to reestablish communication. They don't hear from you, then they're within their rights to assume that you were happy. And if you have 7 days from date of delivery, importantly, not from the date you bought the thing, because the reason for that is, and most countries in the world will have this cooling off period with online purchases, because unlike in a physical shop, you don't have the opportunity to engage with the merchandise, right? You can't touch it, you can't see the true color and all that sort of thing. Pictures can be misleading, so it gives. That's why you have that out. The catch is that the Act says that the supplier can insist that you send it back. So the big guys like the Takealot Group absorb that cost, but most of the others can't afford to. So if you've bought something fairly big and heavy, in effect, that cooling off period is out of your reach, because it's gonna cost you too much to send it back. So that's just something to be aware of. That it's not a practical then to send it back, and now you're taking a big risk.
Well, more gems from Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola telling us about how to get our money back if we are double debited, for instance, or whether we weren't happy with a product and we'd like to be given our money back when it comes to these big corporates. Not easy to do, but if you are steadfast, you will get your cash back.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
One of my favorite features here on The Money Show, the shapeshifter, talking to some of the leading business people in the country and some of the change that they're doing in South Africa's communities. The Green Cab is a taxi group that plans to operate a fully electric fleet. The Cape Town-based business hires women drivers in order to ensure safety. We're joined by one of its co-founders, Emin Fundamava, the founder and managing director of the Green Cab business, joining us from our Cape Town studios. Emin, welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Mateo, and thank you very much for having us.
My first question for you, did you drive an electric vehicle to our studios?
Good one. We often do a show of hands at events to say, how did you actually arrive? Did you car share? Did you, you know, use ride hailing, or did you drive an electric vehicle? Sadly, not yet, but certainly it's on the horizon for us.
It's in the workings then. Let's
very
start
much.
Off with your own upbringing as Emin. Where did you grow up, and what are some of the things, life-changing things that happened in your life that have shaped the businesswoman that we see before us today?
Nice question. Thank you, Mateo. So, very much a Buramesi, grew up on a farm, and then had a relatively conventional journey from studying at Stellenbosch University, and then did some postgraduate studies in multicultural education abroad in America in the late 80s. Always been an entrepreneur, though. In fact, I've yet to write a CV. I do not have a CV, as I've never applied for a job. I think I've always been a pioneer at heart. And I think what led us to, or me in particular, to the green business, and in particular in transport, and our passion for getting women in the driving seat is basically a number of factors, but including the fact that I personally also suffered sexual abuse when I was young, and was pretty much held captive in a teacher's car as we were not able to afford bus fare. So part of the DNA of Green Cab, having been started by five women, is very much that we want to prevent that other women are in similar situations. So we started a good decade ago already. We were completely ahead of the curve. Obviously, it's an ecological recession, and we knew it couldn't be business as usual. And as we say, transport is where the rubber hits the road, because an average of 25%+ of all greenhouse gas emissions is attributable to the transport sector. So we knew we could make good inroads there.
A lot of social impact that comes with this particular business. Why did you decide to drive it this way, if one can put it like that? Because a lot of people will start a business to make money. I know you've shared a bit of your story about the sexual abuse that you went through, but why did you find it important to collaborate with other women to make sure to empower them, especially commercially?
Oh, very much so. Yes, so the driving down emissions is a no-brainer, because it's now the climate crisis is now crisis proportion. And then when we were doing events transport, for the most part, we've serviced more than 100 events, including, for instance, the Green Goal Project with the 2010 World Cup. We did COP17 in Durban, serviced the last four World Economic Forum on Africa events, and there is a very sore lack of women in the driving seat. So we are on a mission to drive equitable, gender equitable urban transport, which will mean that we would need to transform the sector. Because I think currently in e-hailing, women represent less than 2% of all drivers. That raises the question, why? Where are the women? So when I say systemic, we will be starting a women's driving academy to teach women to drive for free, because that's the very first barrier. If you do not have the money to get a license, you can't enter the profession. And it's not made out to be a desirable or an ambition that women hold to say, oh, I'm going to be a cab driver one day. So we want to completely transform that sector, specifically, plugging women into corporate service opportunities, because that will obviously also increase their safety. But it's also about the nature of the work. We don't believe that the current e-hailing sector is a dignified profession, a dignified livelihood. So being plugged into corporate service opportunities, preferred ranking in safe business districts, women will have more reasonable operating hours so they can spend weekends with their families, which is, you know, obviously high on many women's, you know, agenda. So it's simply not a woman-friendly industry. So we've got to work at making it such so we can attract women drivers to the sector.
You and your partners took that brave step more than a decade ago, as you've shared with us now. And some of the clients that you do service, you'd find that the CEO is a man. And of course, there's an unfortunate way of looking at things when it comes to driving, as women drivers not being the best on the road. How are you able to break down those walls and, you know, really prove that you can actually sit in the driving seat, especially, you know, rolling out a business and make sure that you deliver for your clients?
You raised two issues there, hey, Mateo, the safety issue and then male riders. So if I can address them separately, safety as in women's ability to drive. I think if you speak to first for women, they're thriving, because I think very few women claim they would beg to differ with you and say that women
very, very careful. No, I agree with you. Very careful drivers.
Yes, in fact.
It goes without saying. You know, it doesn't matter who's on the driving seat. It just matters whether they have the skill. What I was asking is whether your clients are also welcoming of the business, because you'd find some CEOs or those that are at the top will be asking the question, are we going to be safe with this service? Which is an unfortunate question, because they wouldn't ask that to a man, would they?
Yes, no, not likely. Hey, yeah. So, in terms of app functionalities, we will have, you know, everything that the large international apps have in terms of assisting our women drivers. And I think it just takes, you know, one experience and a good experience for somebody to actually, you know, change that attitude. So that is part of us driving the change. And then the male riders, particularly with corporates, would be a non-issue for us. We will be partnering in all likelihood with a South African woman-only app for our women riders, called Chauffeur. So that gives the opportunity for women riders to hail women drivers. So we will be the green button, you know, on that particular app, and we're exploring launching our own green cab app as well. So when a woman, the model that we are adopting is a micro franchisee model, when she's plugged, as we call it, into a corporate service opportunity, those will be known riders. So we're just removing the safety factor for our drivers by having known riders, irrespective of gender. So obviously for our corporates, that would be men and women. Does that answer it, Mateo?
Definitely, quite well. I mean, just looking into this particular business, have you gone national, or is just still largely based in Cape Town?
Exclusively, and in fact, Mateo, we have defleeted our ICE, our internal combustion engine vehicles. We kind of referred to as the ICE age, just like the dinosaurs died out. You know, ICE vehicles are definitely on a one track to also die out. And we have made an in-principle decision not to refleet in favor of going fully electric. So that is exactly the stage that we are at now. We are securing preferential ranking rights in business districts like Century City in Cape Town, Waterfall City in Midrand. As we then have those LOIs, those contracts, letter of intents of our corporates, we have a facility in place where we will be able to roll out electric vehicles to serve that need, those needs. So that is also what makes us different. We've made the in principle, when we speak about dignified livelihoods, we cannot just put a woman on the road and have a sleep in at the airport in a car and hope for work. So if we only put you on the road once we've secured a particular client, and you are then dedicated to that client, much like any franchisor would do before before it establishes the next Kentucky on the corner. So that will pretty much be our approach. So right now we are speaking to quite a few investors. We're looking for both financing and investors to shift gears and scale our business to the next level, to acquire the first 30 vehicles in Cape Town, whereafter we definitely have our designs on Joburg, because when you service a corporate client, they would need, you know, a footprint in minimally in Cape Town and Joburg. So Joburg is next, but Cape Town will be first. So we basically drive the case down here first.
If you've just joined us, we are chatting to our shapeshifter tonight, Amin van der Merwe, one of the co-founders at The Green Cab. Do join us after this for more on this conversation.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
And our shapeshifter tonight is Amin van der Merwe, the founder and managing director at The Green Cab. Amin, let's pick up the conversation. And what have you learned running this particular business over the past decade? What have you learned most about yourself?
Sure. I think tenacity, like any entrepreneur would tell you, the ability to be flexible and adaptable. There's this little word that is maybe overused, but it's called pivoting. We've had to pivot more than once in our business. It certainly has afforded us time to really deepen our networks, and the electric vehicle and electric transport mobility ecosystem in South Africa is relatively small still, but yes we really were there, kind of pioneering right from the start, from the first electric vehicle industry association launch, you know, right through to the EV forums, etc. So it is afforded us an opportunity because we've been at it so long. For instance, initially we trialed the BMW i3s, which has now become quite an iconic. It's going to be a collectible one day. And at that stage, for instance, rightly so, or understandably so, BMW wouldn't guarantee the level of degradation over, say, the 5 or 6 year financing. So they wouldn't give us longer financing, which one ideally needs, because the electric vehicles are still very expensive. There isn't price parity with ICE vehicles yet. And neither could they tell us, because quite frankly, the vehicles haven't driven that far, for them to be able to be confident to say we back our battery and there won't be, you know, more degradation than 85% over X period, or sorry, 15. It would go no lower than 85%, which is still a lot of battery left. So things have absolutely, you know, rapidly matured, particularly if we think of the past 7 years, like the last 2 years, in terms of charging infrastructure, supply. We're now increasingly being spoiled for choice for vehicles, be they albeit all still, you know, luxury vehicles. We see some new entrants, you know, from the Chinese. And then we've seen vehicles like Volvo EX30 that have just been launched, that is actually have come down in price. You know, it's now more affordable by almost $500,000 than their previous offering, which was the Recharge. Hey. So, sure, it has just afforded us, you know, the kind of the depth of the understanding of what it would take to operate electric, because it's not like operating a regular, you know, diesel or petrol powered fleet at all. But obviously the economics makes perfect sense. There's a wonderful initiatives for us to, that we learn from. For instance, the black cabbies, it's called the TXE City. So the London cabs, they are now electric versions of those. And they had a beautiful campaign for the cabbies that they called hashtag reasons to believe. And I think they calculated over a 3 year period that the saving is something like €25,000. So, What there isn't an understanding yet for is, even though we're buying an expensive vehicle, that vehicle can last longer, and obviously it reduces our operating costs radically. So all of that, you know, the nuances of doing that, we've learned, you know, by doing and being at it for all of this time.
You've been able to sustain this particular business. Are you planning to have the entire value chain where you could have mechanics that are women that service your cars and things like that?
Very, very, very interesting proposition. I know that that's already happening in micro mobility. So, for instance, Matteo, we're doing a very exciting. We've just received a R1 million grant that the Waterfront is matching from an institution called Uyilo that promotes electric mobility in South Africa to scale a micro mobility. So that those are called nano vehicles or quadricycles. So that those are the little vehicles that go where pedestrians go. in the waterfront. And there's definitely the opportunity. For instance, that's a swappable battery. There's definitely an opportunity for localization. I know there's some of the micro, the kind of two-wheelers, pedal assist vehicles, etc., in delivery sector in South Africa, where that's also very much an option. And I think there's more than one company that is looking to empower, you know, women engineers in that way or in that way. However, when you speak about, you know, a 700,000 rand vehicle and it's a Volvo, they don't necessarily want us to tinker with anything. Sure, and also, obviously, one doesn't replace those batteries. They do get a second life, and Volvo's also, in terms of circularity, committed to repurpose and recycle those batteries afterwards.
Then, I mean, what are you doing when you're not working so hard to make sure that women, firstly, are accessed commercially, but also quite safe while traveling around the different cities? Do you have a favorite book that you'd like to read, or are you more of a hobby person and you take up some golf when you are not stressed about work?
I think I'm a little bit more close to earth than golf. I live at the sea, and I was also raised at the ocean, so I'm very much an ocean person and spend as much time in and on it as I can. And I'm an avid hiker. I love to play a game of tennis often. So yes, things that feed one my soul in nature in particular.
And what's your approach to business? Do you believe that you know, you need a little bit of luck, or is it just a grinding and hard work approach to make your business a success?
Sure, maybe a combination of both. And I think if one is in the so-called in the flow, in other words, for instance, just this interview, you know, when we first brought this business to market, there wasn't vaguely the kind of readiness in terms of media exposure, etc., that we are experiencing now. So I guess the time also has to be right, and one has to be patient and position yourself, you know, appropriately to then benefit when the market is ready, and to be that first, you know, that first mover and retain your edge in that way. So a combination of hard work and then just, you know, savvy in positioning oneself to benefit when the time is right.
There are a lot of women that would be listening to this quite inspired. Some also wanted to be partners in a business, especially if it's a franchise model going into other cities. I know you spoke about Waterfall and Cape Town. How do people get a hold of you, and how can they join if they want to be drivers or business partners?
Wonderful. Thank you for that question. They're more than welcome to email us, info@thegreencab.co.za. We're definitely establishing a database, a growing database of women drivers. So what I neglected to say, Mateo, is that we will have a system where we'll own the first 30 vehicles, and the purpose of that, and 170 of them over the, we're aiming for 230 over a 5-year period, 230, is basically to test drive the jockeys, as we say. So women would be driving for us. We make sure that they've got the right entrepreneurial psychology and appetite. And when they prove themselves, a maximum period of 6 months with us, they'll go through a franchisee ignition program, so that we incubate them, and then we really truly hold hands and unlock franchise opportunities for them. So, yeah, we're definitely looking for people who already got licenses, women who would like to learn to drive. We'll have the micromobility project in the waterfront. There we're going to be working in all likelihood with Harambee and having some 20 young women in the driving seat doing various wonderful services in the waterfront. So they can mail us info@thegreencab.co.za.
That sounds fantastic. Then just as we close off, the kind of legacy that you envision for this particular social enterprise, if I can call it that, of course, it is commercial in its own right. But what legacy would you like to see it have in this country?
Sure. I think the issue closest to our heart is really the both climate despondency and then in terms of job creation and for instance, youth unemployment, to really, you know, drive that down as much as we possibly can, because we cannot afford to have a youth that isn't hopeful about the future. So hopefully our legacy is that, you know, the youth will be more hopeful, and that women really will take up their rightful place in the transport sector and be in the driving seat, as they should, of the green economy.
All right, look them up, info@thegreencab.co.za if you want to join them as a driver, or if you have any plans of extending their business. Of course, they have those ambitious plans of getting more than 200 electric vehicles around the country to make sure that they still have women commercially successful in this particular industry. That was our shapeshifter, Amin van der Merwe, the co-founder and managing director at The Green Cab, joining us at our Cape Town studios. Thank you so much for that conversation.